from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
This week on Register Radio, Jeanette DeMello gets a preview of Pope Francis's upcoming schedule from the Register's Rome correspondent, Edward Penton. And later in the show, she'll be talking with the National Right to Life Committee's Mary Spalding Balsh about 2013's pro-life gains and the court challenges those laws face. Welcome again to Register Radio. It's a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the Register. Thanks for joining us this week. Our first guest today, Edward Penton, is the Register's Rome correspondent. He has covered the Register's Vatican news for the last 10 years. Prior to his work with the Register, Edward has reported for Vatican Radio. His work has also appeared in Newsweek, Newsmax, and Zenit, among other publications. Today, he's here to discuss Pope Francis's upcoming schedule and Vatican expectations for 2014. Edward, welcome back to Register Radio.
Hi, good to be with you again, Tom.
Edward, it's been a few months, I think, since we talked to you, but we've started a new year, and recently you wrote a story for the Register. It was called Pope Francis Sets a Busy Slate for 2014, and I'd like to talk to you today about some of the highlights of the next few months for Pope Francis. What's he going to be doing?
Well, he's got a packed agenda in the next few months. As I wrote in the piece, he's got the consistory coming up very soon. The names of the new cardinals will be mentioned probably in the next week or so.
Great.
And he's going to choose probably 14 new cardinals to become members of the College of Cardinals. This is significant, of course, because who he chooses puts in the running who his successor might be.
Right.
So it's a very significant event, a consistory of new cardinals. But that's the first thing that's going to be a major event. Also, next week, he's having his annual meeting with the diplomatic corps to the Holy See, which is always an important event where he gives his assessment of the international scene and his concerns about it. On that same day, there'll be a summit on Syria at the Pontifical Academy for Sciences, which is also a significant event. He probably won't attend that, but it will be important for his pontificate.
Who's involved in that event, the summit on Syria?
Right, well, it's held by the Bishop Sanchez Sorondo, who's head of the Pontifical Academy. He's staging it. And there'll be seven experts, foreign policy experts, attending. People like Mohamed El Baradei, who used to be head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and other foreign policy experts, all of which have the same sort of view as the Vatican and the Pope on this issue, apart from perhaps El Baradei. But they're being brought together really just to sort of, in some ways, influence, if they can, this is what I've heard from diplomatic sources, the talks on Syria, which are going to take place a week later in Geneva, the UN-backed talks.
Yes.
on peace in Syria. So it's quite a significant event, and one which shows very much the Pope's concern for Syria, and particularly the Christians there.
Well, we'll join him in prayer during this time for this very important meeting. And, you know, you mentioned the consistory and the cardinals haven't been named yet. Of course, we hear a lot of rumblings here about Philadelphia or L.A.,
sure.
You know, having a new cardinal, or that's always the case. But it seems as though this pope may not do that. He seems to be someone who's looking towards other countries, for other continents even, for cardinals in this consistory. What is the word on that?
That's right, Jeanette. Yes, well, there's a lot of talk that he'll be, being the first Latin American pontiff, that he'll want to focus on probably bringing in some cardinals from that continent, and having more of an international perspective, perhaps, and move away from Europe, and move away from the rather Italian-heavy presence of cardinals in the college. So there is a significant possibility that that will happen, but of course nobody really knows until the announcement is made. But there's not talk of American cardinals or Canadian new cardinals to such an extent as there has been in previous consistories. But that's not to say there won't be. But it's anyone's guess, really, at the moment.
Well, we're all looking forward to that announcement. This is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking with the Register's Rome correspondent, Edward Penton, about Pope Francis's upcoming schedule. Now, let's see. Pope Francis changed the rules recently for naming Monsignors or giving priests the title Monsignor. Tell us a little bit about that situation. I think there were a lot of headlines about it before the official announcement came, so a lot of misunderstandings. But tell us what's going on with that little change that Francis has put into place.
Yes, well, we're not quite sure why he's done it, because the Vatican hasn't really explained the reasons for it. But he's essentially changed the appointment of a Monsignor. Instead of being in the diocese up until now, any bishop who's seen a priest who he thought is exceptionally able or worthy of the title of Monsignor, he's been able to name him as such. But from now on, he'll have to be over 65 to qualify for that title. Now, that only applies in dioceses. It doesn't apply in the Vatican. You can still have Monsignors under the age of 65 in the Vatican and other places. But as far as dioceses are concerned, that's the case. Now, the reasons that have been said is that it's to try and combat careerism in the clergy, to try and stop any sort of personal ambition, which has sometimes been a very negative aspect of diocesan life, but although not to any great extent. So that's one theory, but it's not really been confirmed by the Vatican, the precise reasons for it. But it is very much in keeping, if you like, with the Pope's wish to try and have a more humble and a more service-oriented clergy than perhaps he's perceived as not having before.
Yeah, there's such an emphasis on the pastoral. But really, there's also an emphasis on reform that we've seen in the last 9 months of this Pope, of this papacy. And tell us a little bit about some of the reforms that have just been recent. I mean, we've got the Vatican hiring a communications firm. I heard, I think, just yesterday reports of greater reforms at the Vatican Bank. What are we looking forward to in the next few months in terms of discussions about reform?
Yes, well, the general trend regarding reform under Pope Francis is really to decentralize it. Decentralize the Vatican particularly, and to try and give a more sort of collegial sense of governance. That seems to be Pope Francis's emphasis, and it's been seen in the various ways he's gone about reform so far. But it's still early days, and we don't really know exactly how the commission and the council of cardinals, of eight cardinals that he's chosen, what sort of conclusions they'll reach after they've met in several meetings later this year. We're expecting to have some sort of draft proposal of reform by midsummer of this year. So we'll know by then kind of how the Pope is going to really tackle all of these different institutions and try and bring about what people have really called for a long time now for much needed reform in the Vatican. And so it's going to be welcomed by a lot of people. Obviously, some people won't be very happy with it, but sure. I think we'll just have to wait and see.
So in about maybe 6 months, we'll start to see some of the nitty-gritty of the reform and what has been in the works, I guess, the last year and a half. Now, it seems like Rome was in such a... It was a tumultuous year in Rome last year. Do you feel as though things are settling down? Has this transition period ended, or are things becoming more, let's say, normal in Rome right now?
In a sense, Jeanette, yes. I mean, the last a few weeks have been a bit quieter than they have been prior to that. But it's certainly been a few months of surprises, as everybody knows, and it's kept us all on our feet. But I think his whole emphasis has been a very obviously one of reform, but also one of continued work, and people have said that he's actually really trying to work himself to the bone almost until for the time he's got left. He's trying to do as much as he can in what he believes probably is a limited, quite a very limited time, really. So he's really hit the ground running, and I don't think that pace is going to let up really anytime soon.
Sure. Well, just as we close, let's talk about the few things we didn't mention. Of course, he's got his first anniversary of the pontificate coming up in March, and right at the same time, you wrote in your story, he'll be starting Lent and leading the church through that wonderful season of Lent, and then Easter, and of course, we've got the great event of the canonization of Blessed Popes John Paul II and John the 23rd. So we really look forward to these big events that are coming in the fall. I mean, excuse me, the spring, and we're also looking to his second trip, I think, outside of Italy, and he'll be traveling to the Holy Land, which happens in May. So, Edward, we're always very appreciative of the work that you do for the Register in Rome, and we look forward to your reporting in the coming months. There's a lot to report on, especially next week with the Syria talks.
Indeed, yes. Thank you very much for having me on. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Edward. When we return, as we look ahead to next week's March for Life and Walk for Life West Coast, you may wonder how the pro-life cause fared in 2013. Well, we're going to talk about that next. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Stay with us.
John at Bankovic talks about the National Catholic Register.
I recommend the National Catholic Register to all Catholics who want to discover what it means to live their faith in this our day and time. We get the clear, unbiased news of today because the National Catholic Register takes its cue from the mind and the heart of the Church. It really becomes a tool by which we are able to live that abundant life in Jesus Christ and to share that life with others. The National Catholic Register seeks to meet people where they are, seeks to meet people where they are in their walk of faith, where they are practically in their lives at the moment.
To start your subscription to the National Catholic Register today, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register or call 800-854-6316. That's EWTN.com and click on the Register subscription banner or call 800-854-6316.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Jeanette DeMello, I'm Tom Price. Our next guest, Mary Spalding Balsh, directs the National Right to Life Committee's Department of State Legislation. Her office is on call to help out the NRLC's affiliates in all 50 states 24/7 to assist them in pro-life legislative efforts. And today she's going to talk with us about the pro-life gains of 2013 and the challenges that those pro-life laws will now face in the courts. Mary, welcome to Register Radio.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Mary, this is Jeanette, and I'm so grateful to have you talking with us today. I've heard news reports that last year, 2013, was a very good year for pro-life legislation. I believe it was the Guttmacher Institute had a recent survey that said 70 provisions were enacted last year that were considered, for them, anti-abortion, for us, pro-life. And I'd like to talk to you about some of those provisions and what those efforts are looking like now.
Well, we did do very well in the state legislatures and have been doing well over the last few years.
Yeah.
A lot of good substantive pro-life laws have been passed and are on the books in several states. The issues that were of greatest importance, I think, were ones that addressed, for instance, the Obamacare insurance policies that are being sold in the states. Many states have been able to pass laws that say that the insurance policies sold through those exchanges not contain abortion. And we've had some victories in preventing that coverage. We also have been able to pass some laws that prevent what we would call a Skype abortion, which is very hard to imagine, but what it basically is where Planned Parenthood has set up these satellite facilities where the abortionist would be in one place and the mother would be in another remote area, and they would meet over a webcam.
Yes.
And it would be and they would be administering chemical abortions. Well, several states have been able to pass laws that require that the abortion practitioner be physically present in the room with the mother prior to giving her a chemical abortion. But there are several other areas that are very important as well. I think that one area where the pro-life movement has been having tremendous movement and success is in passing the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. That is a law that was passed first in Nebraska about mm-hmm. 4 years ago when Nebraska had a problem with a particularly notorious late-term abortionist going on national television and basically inviting people to come to Nebraska to have their late abortions, and that didn't sit well with Nebraska, and so they called us and asked us, you know, what can we do to prevent that from happening here in Nebraska? And a bill was drafted, the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, which is a bill that says that the state has a compelling interest in the life of the unborn child at the point when that unborn child is capable of feeling pain. Well, that became law in Nebraska, and the late abortionist no longer does those late abortions in Nebraska, and several states, taking their cue from Nebraska, passed similar legislation in about 10 other states. That's and really one cool. that is on the horizon right now is one out of Arizona, which, when it was passed, the district court basically upheld the right of the state to protect the pain-capable unborn child, but the Ninth Circuit said no, that it was unconstitutional. Now, that case could, as early as today, be accepted as an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering whether or not to accept that case for discussion, and obviously has a great deal of importance to the pro-life movement, because if the state is able to protect the life of the unborn child at the point when he or she can feel pain, then we obviously have moved forward in this debate about when a human being has the right to be protected from death.
Yes, that's a very important case that we should be following. You said it's Arizona.
Ninth Circuit out of
the
Arizona.
Ninth Circuit. Okay.
And it's a case dealing with their law that banned abortions at the point when the unborn child can feel pain. Now, it's been about 7 years since the U.S. Supreme Court has addressed the abortion issue, mm-hmm. and the states have, and that the last time was when this Supreme Court upheld the federal ban on partial birth abortions. That was the last time that we got a substantive decision dealing with this issue. And it's not that several states haven't made their way up to the Supreme Court. It's just that the Supreme Court has yet to accept a case that they want to address. But there are a few cases that are in the pipeline that we are certainly watching. What is interesting is that our opponents are choosing what new laws in the states to challenge and what laws not to challenge, and they
sure.
have not challenged in the vast majority of states the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. That is law in seven states, and it's enjoined in three, which I find very interesting, because I think our opponents are afraid to challenge the laws where they have to discuss the humanity of the unborn child.
That's
and
right.
I think pain, the fact that the unborn child at some point during his or her development can feel pain, is something that our opponents don't want to discuss. This is something that indicates to the vast majority of the American people that this is a living member of the human family and deserves protection. And our opponents, I don't think they're ready for that debate. But it's something that we want to have, we welcome, and we welcome this. We pray that the U.S. Supreme Court accepts this Arizona case, because I would like to see that issue front and center, because it humanizes the unborn child in a way that we have not been able to do in a long time.
Absolutely, and we'll join you in those prayers. I think that just the title of this, these laws, the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Act, like these kind of titles really help to bring it to the forefront. This is Jeanette DeMello. I'm on Register Radio, and I'm speaking to the National Right to Life Committee's Director of of State Legislation. This is Mary Spalding Balsh, and we are very happy to be talking to Mary about pro-life legislation enacted last year and also some of the challenges they face in this coming year. Now, Mary, what other challenges do some of these laws face? I know Texas right now is facing a challenge to a law that they passed late last year.
Yes, they passed a law that it had several issues in it, including the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, which was not challenged. I find interesting. But what our opponent did challenge in that case is whether or not the abortionist would be required to have admitting privileges at a hospital within a certain number of miles from the abortion facility. This would seem to be common sense legislation, and yet our opponents are very concerned because oftentimes their abortionists are not able to get those admitting privileges, mm-hmm. and they would have to find someone who actually can get those privileges, or they might not be able to perform abortions in those facilities. Now, this case is an interesting case because it's at the trial level, at the district court level, a judge enjoined the admitting privileges section, and then the Fifth Circuit, a three-panel court, actually lifted the injunction, and our opponents appealed that appellate decision to the U.S. Mm-hmm. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, said no, the Fifth Circuit's decision lifting the injunction would stand. And so that the admitting privileges law is in effect right now in Texas pending litigation. So
that's
it's an
great.
Interesting case.
It is. It's a very interesting case. And how many others? Are there others that are being challenged like this?
Well, there are some. There's one that is being challenged in Wisconsin, for instance. They passed a law. And again, what is interesting is what our opponents did not challenge in that particular bill that was passed last year in Wisconsin. They did challenge the admitting privileges section, and it's pending in court. But they did not challenge an ultrasound provision, which basically said that prior to an abortion, that the mother be given the opportunity to view the screen of her unborn child.
Yes.
And that, we think, is a very important issue because ultrasound is a window to the womb, if you will.
Absolutely.
And it shows us the humanity of that unborn child like nothing we have, nothing else that we have. Because
that's so
it's
true.
That child, it's that living member of the human family, and it's that mother's child. And we think that this is something that is a very important aspect of informed consent, and we're trying to get those types of protection in all the states. We still have a long way to go, but we're working on it.
Yes, well, Mary, I'm expecting my first child now, and I had an ultrasound this week. It was a 3D ultrasound, and they had a beautiful up-close picture of my unborn child's face, and just an amazing picture, and I sent that out to my family and some coworkers. And people are just absolutely amazed when they're able to see that life.
Yeah, isn't it amazing how much technology has taken the pro-life cause? Because now when you see that 3D ultrasound, it is irrefutable evidence that this is a child.
Well, that's the beauty, if you will, of the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. It is based on science.
Yeah.
And it's based on science that wasn't available to the court in 1973. Ultrasound was not available to doctors who were dealing with pregnancy back in 1973. But with the onset of ultrasound, doctors, there's a new specialty, for instance, that was not available in 1973. There are neonatal specialists who actually deal with the unborn child as a patient. That was not true mm-hmm. when Roe versus Wade was decided. So all these new advances in science actually emboldened the pro-life movement. It's something that we knew in 1973, but now we have the ultrasound to show the American people, look at this unborn child. You can see his or her beating heart as early as 18 days. You can see into that womb and see that this is a living member of the human family. That was not true in 1973. Fetal surgery, for instance, was not even a possibility in 1973, and yet now it's a specialty in several hospitals around the country where they are performing surgery on these preborn children and fixing them, whatever their disability is, so that when they are born, the disability has been already addressed pre-birth. These are things, that was not known in 1973.
It's so amazing.
An amazing explosion of information. Yeah.
Really, and it's irresistible, I think. And so the more we can cover this, the more we will. The Register is really committed to showing these advances and to really following the work that you do, Mary. Hopefully we can talk to you later in the year about how these things are progressing. We'll certainly join you in prayer and any other way that we can to look and hope that the Supreme Court will take up this Arizona case because it seems so important.
Yeah.
But thank you, Mary, very much for being with us today, and we will pray for your work.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mary. Don't forget, you can listen to our show again by going to ncregister.com. Look for that picture of the microphone to listen to or download the show. Thanks again for joining us on Register Radio. For our producer, Elena Rodriguez, Jeanette, and all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.